Welcome to the Everyday Innovator Podcast for product managers, developers, and innovators. Your host is Chad McAllister, who gives you innovation training your customers will love you for. Get ready to take your career to the next level, for the doctor is in.
Hi, this is Chad, your host and founder of Product Innovation Educators, where product managers become product masters. I enjoyed a wonderful discussion with the Worldwide Director of Design at IBM, Carl Vredenburg. In his role, he leads design efforts, applying design thinking at IBM, and also conducts organizational transformational design workshops with senior executives at major companies around the world. In the interview, you'll hear that design thinking can be applied to a lot more than designing consumer products. He introduced user-centered design at IBM in 1993 and assumed a company-wide role only 2 years later. He has written over 60 conference and journal publications, authored a book entitled User-Centered Design, An Integrated Approach, and contributed chapters to other edited books, as well as served as the editor for special issues of notable design journals. He also hosts the Life Habits podcast, which helps you learn new habits to optimize your life so that you can stay sane in this crazy world. To get the show notes of the discussion, go to www.theeverydayinnovator.com/059. Enjoy the interview. Hi, Carl. Thanks for joining the Everyday Innovators today.
Well, thanks so much for the invite, Chad. Look forward to the conversation.
Absolutely. So let's just dive in about your background in user-centered design. You've been in this field for a number of years now at IBM. But how did you actually get your start with user-centered design?
I actually say to younger audiences some of the time that I was a founder of IBM. Well, it's not quite true. The company's about 104 years old, and I'm not quite that old. But yeah, I started about 27 years ago and was not intended to go into this field at all. I was actually doing a PhD in cognitive science. Was doing some interesting research and really discovered that I was looking at a social phenomenon of there being a big gender difference in the use of computers back then. And so I actually dug into and tried to understand what that difference was due to. I looked at content analysis of advertising. I looked at a variety of other aspects and started to focus on, well, how could we change the actual design of computer systems and computer interfaces so that people would be able to use it, men and women at the time, and also really optimize the experience they have so that they would enjoy it. And so we did a bunch of research on how to increase the enjoyment factor, how to reduce the anxiety factor in dealing with computers, and looked at the effects on self-report, also on indicators like heart rate and galvanic skin response, and then published the results of it. And it was actually really quite popular because I presented it at a conference and the wire service picked it up and the press picked it up and ended up doing a bunch of interviews, much like this one, and but it wasn't in podcasts at the time. And it got picked up quite widely. And somebody at IBM said, let's call this guy, gave me a call and said, had you ever thought of working for IBM? And I said, honestly, no.
Come up yet.
That's right. But at the time, I'd also read this fascinating book about the founders of IBM, Watson Sr., and was thrilled by and fascinated by the culture of the place and the way that it really exuded the particular qualities that I thought was really important. So I said I'd give it a year, and I now have spent that 1 year has now been turned into 27.
How time flies when you're having fun.
That's it.
Excellent. So that must have been a unique contribution to the field to capture so much interest. And that was kind of the time frame when the pioneering work was going on with human-centered design, right? And how we think of man-machine interfaces.
Yeah, the whole, you know, human-computer interaction kind of movement was really going then. There was a real kind of approach to, you know, applying research methods, even quite, you know, rigorously in doing usability studies and all of that. But, you know, the reality was that despite the fact that I was trying to do some stuff back at the university that was really quite innovative, I thought, in terms of really focusing on the design of the interface itself and the mm-hmm. experience that it led to, a lot of the methods work that was going on in the field at the time was really, you know, tail end of the cycle testing, with usability studying, like, we would precisely know what the problems were, but we typically didn't have the time to actually fix them because it was the time that we did that. So that actually led to, just a few years after that, really getting into user-centered design, really loving the approach of a multidisciplinary approach to this, starting off earlier in the cycle, of really understanding the user better, and then, you know, crafting a solution and gathering feedback on it over time. And so I'd taken that user-centered design work that originally was done by Don Norman and team, right, and started to introduce that at IBM. We did some pilot projects early on. Those were really successful. So they decided, even before those projects were completed, to actually use these methods that we were putting together across our, what was then our software group. And then after that, it was company-wide as well. So I ended up writing some of that stuff up in a book and got a bunch more feedback from that as well. So the whole sort of industry went from kind of tail end usability studies over to more of a user centered design approach, which was, you know, broadened earlier on the cycle, as I mm-hmm. said, involved others and the like, but it still had some challenges with it as well that I think we've now addressed with the latest work that we're doing.
Wonderful. It's nice to talk with you since you have such deep experience around that kind of formative period. A few episodes ago, I interviewed Larry Marine, who was in the first graduating class of Don Norman's first cognitive science program. And really interesting how this has all evolved, right? I'm just curious, given this kind of three-decade detour, did you finish the PhD work, or where does that stand?
Interesting question. No. I was actually hired right out of the PhD program, had done all my coursework and the like. And quite frankly, it was actually the move over from sort of pure cognitive science into human-computer interaction and into user experience design that sort of derailed my focus mm-hmm. in terms of the PhD. And I always had intended, Chad, to finish it, but I just still might do that at some point when I retire.
Yeah. It was, that, for personal reasons, that might be good, right? I'm not sure if it's worthwhile now. You've certainly done a lot without it. And my career was different. I never had any intentions of doing that work. And, you know, and after 25 years or so of product development, product management work, started doing my own research, and someone kind of encouraged me. I might as well take the classes along the way, and it worked out well. And I do, one of my hats these days is teaching university classes, and I mentor some PhD students. And getting the coursework done is actually the easy part, right? It's that's right. Actual dissertation is the really weird, challenging part. Okay, so let's dive into the work now. So,
sure.
So when you got to IBM, you quickly became responsible for design, you know, worldwide IBM. And given your background, I kind of expected this to be from that human-computer interactions perspective. And then when I read the description of the keynote that you did at the Product Innovation Management Conference this year, it had a much broader context, right? It wasn't just focused on really user-centered design, but focused on applying design to the business and thinking of it as a team sport that involves all the functions. So over this three-decade period, how has your perspective on design really evolved?
Well, it's evolved in interesting ways. So there is a new movement really focusing on design that I think is getting, you know, real strength, and many, many people across the industry experience that. And it was also the case that we at IBM got a new CEO in the person of Ginni Rometty mm-hmm. Some 3.5-4 years ago. And when she came in as the new CEO, she really got it. She really understood the importance of design, the importance of the client experience to the success of a company. And so she really was a champion of, you know, focusing on the ways in which the IBM company moving into this whole new, you know, transformation of our company in many, many ways, really leading with this aspect of transformation. She then asked one of the senior executives that purports to her to really put together a plan for how to address this. And I'd worked directly with him in the past as well. And we then identified a company that IBM had bought. IBM buys a number of companies, acquires a number of companies like most large corporations do. And there was one company that we bought, Lombardi Software, that didn't have any technology that IBM didn't already have, right? Okay. You say, why the heck would you buy a company if they
Yeah, what was the strategic advantage?
It, right? And the real strategic advantage was this is a company that really used the latest methods of design thinking, you know, from the David Kelly D School, design school from Stanford, IDEO kind of heritage, mm-hmm. had taken that set of methods and put it on steroids for the purposes of business mm-hmm. and the enterprise. And so they had built in some really core additional elements that make generic design thinking even more powerful and more effective in a corporation. So Phil Gilbert is the guy that headed up that acquisition company. And when he came into IBM, he was asked to do the same thing as he had done at the company that he led inside one of the business units that product came into. And he took, for example, 44 products down to 4. Simplified the entire portfolio, made sure that all of the teams were using this design thinking on steroids, if you will. And when Ginni Rometty came in as the CEO, it was really a fairly easy decision to say, you know what, let's get Phil Gilbert and the approach that he was using, let's really inject that into the way in which we do this across the company. And he famously was asked, you know, do you think that this would work? And he said, well, I don't know, but let's give it a go, right? And that's right. Just the way Phil is. So I now report to Phil, Phil Gilbert, and he's the general manager of design across the company, director of design, and a very small group of us really formulated this new direction. And the new direction was very much one of not just the design method or framework itself, which is what I just briefly mentioned, mm-hmm. but it also is really transforming the entire company so that it has a cultural perspective and you change the culture to be design-led, to have empathy for, you know, the user, to be able to iterate significantly, all of the characteristics. Now, we do it by focusing in three different areas. We focus on what we call the people, the places, and the practices. And if you put those three things together,
the three P's,
you got mm-hmm. it. You get the outcome of increased business success and customer satisfaction. And so the people side was we needed to hire more designers, more, you know, formally trained, you know, directly out of design school designers of the form of visual design, user experience design, user research, and what we call front-end development, the engineers that can actually create the user interface. Those are the four disciplines that we decided we needed to drastically hire more of. Okay. So we went out to hire from the top design schools all around the world. We've hired some 500 or so in the last couple of years or so. And we now we're at about 1,100 designers in the company, and we still need to be growing that significantly as well. But in addition to
let me ask you about that, Carl.
So
already a large global company, IBM for sure, but this is a pretty rapid increase, you know, to go from 500 to 1,100 now. What are those designers being put to use for?
Yeah, really good question. So We have designers that work in all parts of IBM. So IBM creates products, often now cloud-based, services-based products. We also have a services business, our global business services organization, and we have a unit or a service line in that called Interactive Experience, which is basically a design agency that has designers worldwide. We also have a our marketing and communication, marketing and innovation team as well for our digital properties and the like as well. So our designers go into each of those, you know, units. But it's really important, Chad, to point out that what we did when we first started this program was not to take, you know, the 1,000 or so designers and then spread them evenly across all of that. I mean, we have some 3,000, 4,000 products, for example. If you took those designers and just spread them evenly, you'd have, you know, no impact whatsoever, I would suggest, mm-hmm. right? So what we decided to do instead was put together a program called the Hallmark Program. And the Hallmark Program is as an opt-in program. So a project team needs to satisfy some key criteria to be considered to be included in this program. And if they get in the program, they also get the designers, they get the support from our organization to do the work that we need to do and the like. So there's a demand in the company for actually getting into this program. And we have at any one time about 100 projects, probably to a maximum of about 150 projects that we do in this intense way. So instead of, like I said earlier, having like a half a designer assigned to a project, we instead, for a particular product area, will assign 50, mm-hmm. you know, another one will be 70, you know, so that we can really make a difference in the most important, you know, aspects of the company.
Okay.
So that's the strategy for doing this. But very importantly, it's also not just about designers, right? It's also about the entire team. So one of the things that we put in place to really transform the way the company does its work, and we started this in the product divisions, and then took it into the services organizations and then even into the sales organizations as well. But in the product organizations in particular, we wanted to make sure that this isn't just doing things differently as designers. This is very importantly, as you said earlier, a team sport. So we want to make sure that we have designers, you know, business people, product managers and product development leaders, as well as engineers, all working really closely together. And they all have a role to play in this thing that we call IBM design thinking. That's our version of the framework. So in order to get them immersed in how to do this thing called IBM design thinking, we actually have these IBM design thinking workshops where when in the earliest days, when we introduced this to the product teams, all of the, like, we'd take maybe two product managers, two designers, and two engineers, typically the lead architects, would go to a location. We started all this in Austin, Texas. We have a big studio there. And the team would work there for a week in one of these workshops. And they would be learning by doing, experiential learning of the methods, but they'd also be progressing their project. So at the end of the week, their project would be significantly enhanced, but they also learned the basics of our overall framework moving forward as well. And then they'd go back into their organizations and the like as well. So that was the way that we kind of engineered not only the adoption of these methods, which, by the way, we don't call it a process, we call it a framework, because we feel that if you call something a process, it becomes a checklist and people stop thinking, mm-hmm. right? And so we make sure that everybody learns the framework. We also believe that you need to have the right environment for good design and innovation to happen. Mm-hmm. And so we focus on what we call studios. And there's a bunch of characteristics about creating a space that is open, that is collaborative, that is inspiring, that also allows teams to leave their design artifacts up in the walls and that every wall can be drawn on, for example. So we've been creating those and we've got some 26 studios like that around the world now. And then, you know, the last thing is this practices piece. So people, places, and practices. The practices piece is all about this IBM design thinking framework itself, which is grounded in really having empathy for the user, whatever it is that we're creating. I mean, you can use this method to create absolutely anything, whether it's a process, whether it's a backend, you know, system, whether it's a new app, Or if it's the way that you run your child's a soccer team, you can apply these methods to virtually anything. But they start with deeply understanding the user and then being able to look at what their as-is experience is, what pain points they have, ideating on solutions to those pain points, getting clarity on which of the ideas are better than others, and then actually starting to prototype up and gather, you know, feedback on them as well. And then very importantly, in addition to the core design thinking sort of framework, if you will, we've added a few additional pieces that are powerful in business and so that we can, you know, gearbox this effectively in organizations that really need to go adopt and do this work. And those things are, one of the things is called HILS, which is an articulation of the objectives that you've got for the project in the form of who is going to be able to do what and what's going to be their wow experience. They're simple sentences just stating that. There's three of them and only three. There is one fourth. The fourth is a technical foundation hill, we call it. It's the stuff you have to do, you know, operating updates, bug fixes, all the stuff that isn't going to be core to the way that somebody that's buying your product or buying your service is going to get the value from it. These top three are all about making sure that you're describing what you, Chad, as a user, are going to get in terms of value from the system, not in our company's terminology, but in the terminology of the user that it's designed for.
And I'm curious, what's the metaphor with calling them hills?
Oh, it essentially comes from Phil himself, is really a military concept of the commander's intent. The commander's intent is all about that if a commander of military unit were to, you know, tell his team to do what he wanted them to do, or she for that matter, they wouldn't be saying, oh, well, I'd like you to take this piece of weaponry and be able to, you know, if you encounter this, do this. You're not going to micromanage them, right? You're going to give a commander's intent to say, I want you to do whatever you can to take that hill. And it's up to you and your team, and you're empowered to go figure this out. So the notion here is that it's the commander's intent to take a particular hill. And so a team, a product team, a client team, will have, for example, a hill that they could be able to stare at and say, you know what? There's a many ways to achieve that hill. You can actually build it this way. You can do it more as part of a service, part of a product. You can figure it out. Whichever way you want to deliver on that hill, if you achieve that hill, that's really the business objective we have. So it's a really powerful, I think one of the most powerful aspects of our overall approach. There are several others too, but one of the other very important ones is this notion of a playback, which is all about getting all the stakeholders together, Chad, in a room or even virtually, and walking through the client experience that's evolving from the earliest stages all the way through it being, you know, built. And it's an opportunity for all the key stakeholders to not just be doing the typical things you do in meetings, you know, in terms of looking at bug counts or looking at, no, now you're actually looking at the client experience the way that it's evolving. And when I work with a lot of clients, I say, you know what? If the digital experience that people have with a company is often as important or more important than a lot of the other products, like a bank, for example, the financial products they create, are they important? Yeah. But their digital experience with their company through apps and through a website or whatever is significantly important. And how much of the time does a senior team, for example, review and see what the future plans are for what that, you know, client digital experience is going to be? Not often. So that's what these are all about as well, to make sure that everybody's on the same page and that you make corrections early on when you say, you know, even if this were just some ideational elements of some potential directions you want to go, and it's a low fidelity form, we can catch things and say, oh, you know what? I think you need to be amping up that part here, or hey, you know, what about doing it this way instead? So everybody is focused on that client experience.
It really sounds like you're instilling design thinking into the culture through these workshops that you started, through the designers that you're bringing on that are probably carrying the message and evangelizing. And using it as a way to collaborate across all the key stakeholders and projects.
No, it really is. And it's the way to really resolve issues that often teams, you know, have, because a lot of the methods are ways of getting people outside of themselves. Mm-hmm. And so I've also been taking for the last 2 years or so these methods to our clients. So some of our biggest clients ask about what this is all about. And I'll run like a workshop, like a day or a 2 day workshop with like the C-suite of a client. And I work them through a potential a set of problems that they provide to me. And I help scope it a little and vet it a little in terms of what the focus should be. But a very common comment is for those senior executives, even like a C-suite, will come back and say, you know what, Carl, what I really loved about this stuff is, you know, we have little fiefdoms inside, you know, the organization. I mean, this group is, you know, more powerful than that one. Or when we're in meetings, you know, it's the more senior executive that it gets listened to, or it's the loudest person in the room or whatever. But the ways in which these methods are done and carried out in these workshops, the beauty of them is that we start off by everybody getting up on the board. In fact, the C-suite ones, we start right away with an activity without even talking about anything so that they actually start working, right? Mm-hmm. So not just debating, but they start working. They get their post-it notepad out. They start to work on stuff. And all the way through these methods, it's you start by diverging. Everybody's ideas count. You put them up on the board. After a while, who wrote those post-it notes? Is lost,
right?
They're just ideas up on the board, right? And then we consolidate, right? Where we're now voting on ideas and clusters of ideas, and the ideas become one of their own. So they are not just owned by a person. So everybody now is focused on kind of the North Star, which is their client, the client's client in our case. Mm-hmm. And they're all now thinking about what that amazing experience could be for the client, and they're less worried about differences between line of business versus IT and a lot of the traditional kinds of challenges that organizations have with one another and inside their own organization. So is this a transformational, you know, approach? Absolutely. And there's a lot of interest across the various industries now to both digitize and dramatically, you know, convert their operations to very digital ones, especially with mobile. But there's also a desire to change the way that companies work, because a lot of companies are now being disrupted by startups that are working very differently mm-hmm. from the way that traditional companies have worked. And in our experience, the startups can get benefit from this work because sure. I was on a panel in Mountain View of sort of the main startups on the stage with me, right? The successful ones. And we're having a debate about whether you needed to do user research to be able to really understand the problem before you tried to ideate and come up with a solution. And a number of them were saying, well, no, you just got to go start coding and then just put stuff out there, right? And I said, you know what? The stats suggest that only 10% of startups are successful, and you guys sitting on the stage with me are the successful ones.
Right.
The ones that were in the audience were not, largely, right? And so I said, I work for a company that needs better odds than 10%.
Right.
And so you can increase those odds. In fact, the research that looked into, you know, why startups fail, a large part of that is actually the core elements that we're talking about here, understanding the market, understanding the user, understanding what skills you need and all of that. But so startups can benefit from this, but also large corporations that are being disrupted by those startups Absolutely. Are all realizing they've got to be more innovative, yep. right? So there's a real thirst for this approach right across many industries.
Absolutely. I'll tell you, I'll share a quick story, which is also in a previous episode, Van Gogh Art, a little startup there in Silicon Valley that actually started in, I think it was in Dubai. The guy that started it, a friend, was over there. And he went to a hackathon, right? And the quick story is he was walking into the hackathon. The person he was supposed to be on a team with decided to abandon him. He decided, well, I'll go do something else for my weekend. And he bumped into this other guy in the parking lot. They got started talking about art and how hard it is to find original art. They decided to go do the hackathon together. He's a design thinking practitioner. They spent the entire first day going to the mall, doing 100 interviews with customers. They did some quick mock-ups on what this thing would look like, and they won the hackathon competition, right? And now they've raised money in Silicon Valley, and they're, you know, moving on. And I appreciate that you said, you know, design thinking applies across the spectrum from the big enterprise down to the startup too. The other thing, I want to dive into this transformational aspect a little bit. So you have this engine kind of rolling, it sounds like, with this new design force doing these workshops. This is a pretty big change in just the last few years. And we think of design thinking as being focused on helping us do a good job of creating products that solve a customer's problem and provide them value. But you, it sounds like this is getting instilled into the culture, which could do really powerful things to IBM itself. Like, you might be poised to do this. I don't want to beat around the bush here, but it sounds like you're getting ready for a big transformation, right? It sounds like you're empowering the company to really transform to a new level of performance.
Oh, absolutely. And that is exactly what we're in the midst of. And are we done? Do we have all the answers? No. Have we made significant progress on all this stuff? Absolutely. But, you know, our CEO still says, you know, our design program is really the core of the engine of the transformation that we're making. And a lot of the clients that we're working with that are also interested in a similar transformation also want to go down this path. So there are a lot of, and I spend a lot of my time with clients these days, and there is a common set of themes. I mean, companies realize that they want to be more innovative, and so they'll hire, for example, a vice president or a senior vice president of innovation. They will sit there and think for a while, and we'll try various things, and often just, you know, bring together people within the organization that sit around trying to think of innovative thoughts, you know, and they don't find they're being very successful.
Right.
And so, you know, after a year or so, a common pattern is, we hear IBM's doing this thing. Let's hear about the way that IBM's doing that. Hmm. And so the notion of actually putting in more of a rigorous approach to doing the very thing we've been talking about is then met with, you know, significant interest and for us working, you know, with them in helping them transform. There are other sort of patterns that go on as well, where teams are really transforming or intending to transform themselves, and they take some of the piece parts. So I've met with teams that have, you know, hired designers, lots of them. And straight out of, you know, design school, straight out of college. And then they wonder, they're not getting very great success. You say, well, maybe that model wasn't a very good one. So in our case, when I talked about the design workshops that we do for our new hire designers, we actually have what we call a boot camp, an IBM Design Thinking boot camp that is 3 months long. Like, so our onboarding for straight, you know, hire straight out of school types of designers and front-end devs, they go into a three-month program that is intensely designed to teach a common understanding of our framework, also core things that, quite frankly, some of the universities and design schools aren't teaching. So we're needing to make up for some of the things that are not being taught. We are now also working directly with those design schools, by the way, to also feedback, saying this is what we're noticing we need. And so they're starting to do that. Same thing with some of the business schools, by the way. We talked earlier about the importance of sort of contributing to the engine that creates the people that come into our companies. I'm also working with one of the business schools here to inject IBM design thinking into the MBA and MBA programs to make sure that we're not just teaching in an MBA program the analytical thinking way of approaching problems, but instead also the design thinking way as well, and knowing when to use which. So if you want to, you know, reduce cost and you want to sort of optimize your operation, analytical thinking is amazing. If you want to innovate, you got to use design thinking.
Right.
And can you use the same rules from analytical thinking on the early stages of design thinking? No. Are you going to be able to have a perfect estimate of the increase in sales you're going to get with a particular project if you're doing something brand new? No, you're not. I mean, it's just like when the first iPhone came out, when Apple created that, There was no way in heck they knew it would whether it would be or to any sort of analytical degree how successful it would be. But so a lot of companies are picking up pieces of this. Like they realize they need to have designers, so they hire them,
right.
But they don't necessarily have a program to really instruct them and teach them and bring them into the program. Some of the companies are also buying design firms
right.
as a way of doing that. We chose not to do that. Mm-hmm. We chose the approach of actually having designers come into IBM.
Be more organic.
And really learn what the company's all about.
Right.
So I think there's an incredible appetite, like I say. And like I said, we don't have all the answers, but we give it a lot of thought. And one of the things that the benefits of having Phil Gilbert as our general manager, because he was a serial entrepreneur until he came to IBM, and IBM's a startup, but 104 year old one. But when he came in, we have on our leadership team pivot meetings, the pivot meetings that startups would have. Hmm. But if you're almost a 500,000 person company, why can't you do the same things that startups do, right? So we have these pivot meetings once a quarter where all the roles on the leadership team, all of the programs that we're running, they can all be thrown up the air. We can kill any one of them, start a new one. Mm-hmm. At one point, for example, about a year ago, a little more than a year ago, we discovered that we needed to sort of amp up our focus on front-end development. We now had great designers, but we didn't have all the capability to be able to actually code some mm-hmm. of that great design using the best toolkits and the latest toolkits. So we now have a massive focus on hiring front-end developers and also educating the ones inside the company as well.
Very good. So we've talked through a lot of things that I would love to poke on more if we had time, but a lot of nuggets in there. And you've given some good advice. The everyday innovators are listening kind of across the spectrum of new product managers up to chief innovation officers in companies, right? And you've already kind of addressed some advice for the chief innovation officer type role, which is the power of design thinking to extend beyond just doing a better job with innovations, but giving you really that critical lever in your organization to help you transform the organization to a new level of performance. Let's look at the other perspective real quick, the mm-hmm. other side of the spectrum. What would you tell a young new product manager, some key bits of wisdom that are really going to help them be more successful in their careers as it develops?
Great question. Yeah, I think all disciplines, including new product development leaders, need to think about the notion of a T-shaped person, T-shaped professional, which means a focus on deep knowledge in one aspect of an area of specialization, but also having sufficient knowledge of the others, as well, that are relevant to the creation of whatever product or service that you're working on. And so the days of somebody being, myopically focused on a single slice of knowledge and skill and experience are over, I think. In order to be really effective, you need to have a broad set of skills and still have your specialization as well. And then I think the notion of actually getting grounded in the design thinking, framework and the kinds of thinking, the approaches and the like that we use to that, and also to really keep that, the client and the user as the North Star for everything you do. Like a lot of the time we get, caught up in let's do some spreadsheets of market analysis and now let's look at, the key trends and all. You can do all of that. But if you don't ground that, no matter which of these disciplines, in kind of who it is that you're designing this for really, mm-hmm. And if you can't explain it to somebody that's not a specialist in the field easily, then you're still in trouble, right? So this whole notion of getting grounded in the human aspects of what it is that we do, I think was the other thing that I would reinforce.
Yeah, actually get out of the cubicle in the office and meet with real customers and know how to have those interactions. Which is uncomfortable for a lot of people that end up in product management, because a lot of us come from typically it's either the business role or the technical role. And from the technical role, bad stereotype, but there's a reason why they exist. We tend to be the person from the technical role that isn't as customer focused. Mm-hmm. And that just comes through experience, right? Having those conversations and getting in touch with the customer. I would think of the T-shaped person, you know, as a twist on the idiom of it's really the jack of all trades and the master of one, right? Yeah. At least one.
Oh, I love that.
Right? You have depth there in some area. And I appreciate you emphasizing the importance of the T-shaped person.
The other thing that I think is important when you're talking about sort of the technical leader role, I've been spending a lot of time with kind of sales and tech sales and sort of architects. And there's a desire, I think, that a lot of people have that are client facing to look brilliant, to have all the great, wonderful answers.
Right.
When they don't necessarily know what the questions are. Right. And so I think there's a need to listen, listen deeply. And the other characterization, by the way, when we talked about user-centered design and now design thinking, and one of the key aspects that's different about those two is that back in the user-centered design days, we were all about designing for efficiency, knowing tasks and task analyses. You cared about what a person did, right? And what we do now is we look at what we call sort of 360-degree view of the person. You know, what is the person, you know, what do they do? But what do they think? What do they say to others? What do they feel?
Right.
And the feeling is often more important than even the others in terms of what it is that you do, right? I put together the first design team for the commercialization of Watson. Mm. And Watson was, you know, it's an amazing technology. And we were putting it into oncology. Helping with the recommendation of treatment protocols for oncologists. And so we did a bunch of ethnographic research, and we asked questions of, you know, the key oncologists, and said questions like, you know, what keeps you up at night?
Right.
And what is it? What gets you up in the morning? What do you love about this job? Right. And when we asked the question about what keeps you up at night, well, I worry that I've missed something. And I've missed something in the patient record, I've missed something in the literature in the last few years. And of course, Watson sucks all that in. But we were being too efficient in the way that we actually designed the product early on. And we needed to actually provide more context for, you know, what sources are we basing our recommendations on and the like as well. So the aspects of all aspects of the human being. So like you say, we need to get out of there and talk to people and understand them. But you also got to listen to them and observe them to really know what some of the key real differentiators that your company can put into a product or a service based on deep understanding of who it is you're designing it for and what their challenges are.
Right. Which sounds simplistic and straightforward and incredibly complicated to actually execute well on. Right.
That's right.
And I appreciate you joining us and sharing your vast experiences at IBM and what the company's doing now and what you're learning too and applying design thinking for the large enterprise. And as you know, I love innovation quotes, and my listeners know this too. And I asked you to bring one. What did you bring to share, and why did you choose that one?
Yeah, the quote that I like to use is one from a talk that our second CEO from IBM, Thomas J. Watson Jr., gave at the Wharton Business School in 1973. He said, good design is good business. And that's still true. And fact was true back then, but even more so, more true today. Mm-hmm. And it still largely guides, I think, the way that I think about this whole environment that we're in. And a lot of the conversation that we've just had saying, you know, what does it take to really be successful? Well, you got to do good design in all the ways that may come about. And I think it's still something that many years since that time, you can look at it and say, well, is that, if you look at the most successful companies right now and how they're focusing on design and the correlation between the focus on design and business results, it's borne out, I think, the quote from 1973.
And it has stood the test of time, too. Wonderful. Thanks for sharing that. And as a wrap-up, I'm sure there's people listening who are interested in getting more information about your work and what you've done. And I mentioned in the introduction that you have a podcast also. So share how people can find out more about that.
My website is just my first name, lastname.com, carlvredenburg.com. You can also follow me on Twitter, at same thing, Carl Vredenburg. when you have a unique name, you get to have the domain and you get to have all the coordinates, social media coordinates as well. You can also link with me on LinkedIn. And from the company point of view, I would suggest you follow ibm.com/design. You would expect that we would have a simple URL, right? ibm.com/design. And you can follow us on Twitter there as well, at IBM Design.
Very good. And on Life Habits, your podcast is simply called Life Habits.
Yeah, it's called just Life Habits. You just search in any of the podcast aggregators on iTunes as well. Just look for Life Habits and you'll see it right there and you can subscribe to it. And what that is all about, by the way, is really a mentoring podcast that started inside the company when I was doing a bunch of mentoring. And it just sort of grew from there. Mm-hmm. Of just very practical advice on how to improve the way that you approach your day-to-day work. And so I encourage anybody that's interested to follow that as well.
Excellent. Carl, again, thank you for your time and thanks for sharing the information with the Everyday Innovators.
I very much enjoyed it. Thanks so much, Chad.
Thank you for listening and thank you for recommending this podcast to your colleagues. You'll find all the notes from the discussion with Carl at theeverydayinnovator.com/059. Please check it out. Keep innovating.
Thank you for listening to Product Innovation Training your customers will love you for. To learn more, please check out the blog at theeverydayinnovator.com. Keep innovating.